Stop kissing on me. It's time for...
In the Corner. Back by the Woodpile.
I'm Spun Counter Guy. Thanks for stopping by. Joining us back by the Woodpile today is a feller who's been a redneck in pain, a fun girl from Mont Pilot, a wrestling manager named Kat, a Japanese wrestler named Photon, and not to be pigeonholed, he's recently been writing exclusive reviews of fish sandwiches. Meet the multifaceted Charles Tidball. I first knew this guy from a handicap services company we both worked at. He was the human resources person, and I'll never forget the first day we met where he was presenting an in-service on safety and emergency procedures to a group of us. All of a sudden, he stopped talking, and we looked up to find he had fallen asleep in mid-sentence. We trainees just looked at each other, not knowing what to do. I suggested that maybe the solution was in the procedural manual our presenter was now slumped over. One lady suggested we go to lunch and let the poor guy get some rest. So as we walked out, I asked, who falls asleep during his own speech? Someone explained, oh, Charles is in some kind of Andy Griffith punk band. Probably had a late gig last night. So Mr. Tidball began our chat back by the Woodpile about his membership in one of the several underground punk bands that thrashed about throughout the Mid-South during the late 80s.
What I remember doing is back in like the mid-80s, I remember I was in high school, I wanted to get a punk rock band together. I grew up in White House, Tennessee, but there's nothing going on in White House, so at least not that time especially. But me and my friends would come to Nashville, and that's where we discovered like the big underground music and punk rock scene and college alternative radio and all that.
Who was big in Nashville as far as the underground? Who were some of the bands that...
Well, when I first started getting into it, I remember, what they call the classic time of 91 rock, that the 80s. I remember bands like Shadow 15 and Raging Fire, Jet Black Factory, In Pursuit, The Movement, different bands like that. And then on the more punk rock, like really underground, that didn't even get hardly any radio play, the first bands I remember is a band called Fatal PMS, which and then there is what else was there? Johnny Panic and the Bible of Dreams. It's kind of hard to remember. There were so many that just kind of came and went pretty quickly.
And when you say 91 rock, you're referring to the radio station that they built for those listening outside the area.
Oh yeah, so. Right.
Okay, so what was the first band that you put together?
The first one that got together and played. I joined them. I tried to practice with a few people and put stuff together, and nothing ever came about it. But there was a band in town called Rednecks in Pain, and they were looking for a new singer.
R.I.P.
Yeah, R.I.P. Rednecks in Pain. Yeah. So, a mutual friend told them about me, and they were trying to keep it hush hush because they didn't really want their current singer to know they were looking to replace him at the time.
Yeah.
And I went and tried out for them, and that was the first band I joined that actually performed anywhere. So.
With Rednecks in Pain, was it comical stuff or was it pretty serious?
It's hard to say. I mean,
that's why I asked the question.
Yeah, because I mean, it was. It seemed like there was always kind of a living contradiction almost, because with a name like Rednecks in Pain and with the logos and cartoons and stuff that were done, it seemed like it was kind of comical. But when you talk to the guys in the band, like the guitar player that wrote most of the music, he was like all wanting to be like serious, mean, angry punk rock. But I was writing the lyrics, and they gave me some lyrics when I first started, which I don't know, they were kind of, I don't know if I'd call them funny or serious or what. It was kind of hard to really identify what, to me it was hard to identify what they were getting at. So when I wrote my own lyrics, I think most of what I started off writing was kind of comical, but with kind of a, maybe more of like a social satire, I guess, almost. There were some songs that were just complete nonsense that I wrote. I mean, I wrote a song called Mealtime about just eating a lot of food, But, especially the longer I was in the band, the more I kind of, I tried to have a humorous edge, but, I did start writing about things that, at least were important to me at the time, although now I look back at them, they're probably pretty comical. A lot of lyrics are pretty comical unintentionally.
Yeah. Why did they get rid of the other guy?
Oh, that's a, it's a...
Was it rednecky enough? Wasn't enough pain?
Well, almost too rednecky, actually. Oh, right. I mean, it was a friend of theirs from high school, and he really didn't have a lot of knowledge about, you know, punk rock or anything. He was, you know, he was just a friend of theirs, and they all kind of came from, like, a heavy metal background, and then kind of transitioned into punk rock. Like, the first show, they didn't even have a singer. They pulled some guy out of the audience, and, you know, they got... Apparently, everybody liked him. He didn't want to sing with them, so they got their friend to sing with them, and he was like doing stuff like you know, between songs yelling like Dallas Cowboys woo and stuff like that, you know.
But he was for real.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, and yeah, and you know, and the people there were just like, this guy just doesn't, you know, doesn't quite know what we're about or something.
Well, let's jump to that subject. Punk.
Yeah.
I mean, what is it? It seems to be railing against, you know, some mainstream culture at times, but of course these days, as people grow older, it's become a mainstream culture in itself, or it's become an establishment. And so, in your opinion, what was it then when you were getting into it, or why did you get into it? What is it now? I mean,
well, that's several different questions.
Yeah, sorry.
The aspect that I got into it about that I liked were two things. One, I liked the fact it was something that, you know, where you could be an outcast and be embraced and not, you know. Suppose, well, this is in theory, I guess, because it's in practice, it's, you know...
Still a bunch of little tribes.
Yeah. But, I mean,
too
the
cool
idea...
For school.
Yeah, the idea was, you know, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't in any of the good social cliques in high school, supposedly good, I say, but, you know, the popular cliques or whatever. And I liked that there was something out there that I could just be myself and be embraced by and, you know, meet other people that were different and, you know, not have to worry about conforming to whatever the mainstream culture was. And the second part, I like the music. I mean, I'd never heard anything like that that was so energetic, that seemed so original, didn't seem to be obsessed with musicianship and being overproduced, and it was just kind of anyone could do it kind of thing. That's what I liked about it.
What was the first band you heard that made you want to do punk music?
When I first started hearing music, I mean, I was subjected to whatever was on the radio, so I'd hear new wave bands and think they were punk bands. So, you know, that kind of, you know, I guess opened the door for me. But probably... the first thing I really remember hearing that kind of blew me away, that's kind of tough to say, but I probably one of the first, if not the first, was the Ramones, because I remember watching the movie Vacation, and the kids put their headphones on, and their Blitzkrieg Bop was playing in there, and I just thought, I said, what is that song? That is so cool, you know. So that was, I remember that. That was one of the first things. And then when I was introduced to 91 Rock and got in, saying I heard the Ramones there too, but I also remember thinking from the soundtrack to Repo Man was, you know, one of the first things I heard. I loved that whole soundtrack except the plugs. I didn't care for them. But
what was your apex for Rednecks and Panty? Like, what was the height of y'all's career?
You know, going back to when I was into, you know, getting into punk music and listening to things, there were all these independent labels, still are. One of them at the time, was Mystic Records, which, you know, didn't have a lot of good bands, really, but at the time I thought they were great, you know, because they were, you know, I was into everything, and they had a lot of bands. They put out tons of music. And the last record we put out, the guy that ran Mystic Records, he had like a subsidiary of it for 7-inch records he called Super 7. And he distributed, and, you know, we put us on that label. In reality, it didn't do anything for us. I mean, we didn't get any more money than when we were self-putting music out. I don't even think.
But you could put that on your resume.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah. To me, it was a big deal at the time. Right. You know, it was. I don't even know if they had even that much more distribution. I guess it, in theory, did, but I know we didn't sell any more records or to speak of, or, you know, or to any new places to speak of than we did when we were doing it on our own. So,
what was your favorite song they all did?
It was either Jenny's Little Crisis or Dancing with Manson. I like both of those too.
And what was Jenny's Little Crisis?
That was almost based on a true story in a way. It was more based on a true lie. So, I had a friend who went on a date with this girl, and it was a blind date, and she was not impressed when she met him, and was becoming less impressed as the date was going on. And so she uh, she phoned her friend, whose actual name was Jenny, and said, I got to get out of this. I need you to, you know, I'm going to pretend that I'm calling you and that you have this big crisis going on and I've got to leave.
Oh.
And between the idea of liking songs with people's names in them and then taking that story and thinking, you know, thinking like, well, what if she did have a crisis? You know, what if there was a real major problem going on? So I wrote the song as if there was this person named, you know, Jenny was like, you know, having this like, you know, crazy, like, you know, psychopathic, you know, murder spree or something.
And who's Dancing with Manson?
It's kind of a nonsense song, but I had some friends that had a band called Word Uprising, and they had a song called Patty Hearst, and kind of as a, and I was friends with them and, you know, a fan of that song, so kind of almost as a callback to that. Years later, I found out that there was another band that put out a record, a band called Therapy, not even from Nashville or anything, and they had a song called Dancing with Manson.
Really?
Yeah, total coincidence, I assume, because...
Did you hear from the lawyers?
No, in fact, they should have heard from our lawyers. We wrote our song first.
Yeah. At that time, what venues did you play?
The main one was Ellison Square, now called The End. They did most of the all-ages punk rock shows. There were a few others that, you know, came and went kind of fast. I remember there was like a underground deli up on Church Street that we did a few shows at.
Now, you played in Murfreesboro a lot.
We did, too. Yeah. The Borough has always been the place in Murfreesboro.
A mutual friend of ours, I mentioned that I was going to do this, and... He didn't know who you were, and then when I mentioned Rednecks and Pain, he's like, oh man, I saw them in Murfreesboro back in college or something.
Oh yeah, the Borough has been there, I mean, since before Rednecks and Pain, and is still there, and as far as I know, they're still like the main place in Murfreesboro, other than, I think Murfreesboro has places that do house shows now, but I mean, for an actual club, yeah, the Borough has been kind of a, you know, underground music place for that.
What's the most interesting story from that time?
I don't know, to me, I always remember the funny things, and our guitar player was a heavy drinker at the time, and he would always he seemed like he was always getting into something, and we were on our way to somewhere, and everyone in the band but me drank, but him especially, and the drummer drank a lot, but they I forget how much beer they had on the way there. It was a long trip. I can't remember where we even were going. You know, they had enough beer that anyone should be pretty well set for whatever they're going to do that night. And we got into the town, and they wanted to get more beer. And they stopped, and it was a dry county.
Oh.
And the guitar player started freaking out, going, what are we going to do? And they think he still had, like, I think he even still had a six-pack left from however much beer they brought with them. And it was like, you know, well, we're late for the show. We need to get to the show and play. You're going to drink that six-pack of beer, and we're going to play the show. He's going, no, exactly. We got to go back, like, 30 miles to the, or 30 no. hours to an hour to the next town and get more beer because this is a dry county. And it was like, fortunately, me and the bass player were like, no, we got to just do the show. Just deal with what you have. We'll get some after the show. And so after the show, wherever we stay, whatever house we stay at, they had beer there. Oh, and this is of course, I forget this part. On the way there, while he's wanting more beer, he keeps yelling, 12-pack, 12-pack, and just being obnoxious as hell. And so... When he get after the show's done, we get that he's drinking more beer. He got his 12-pack, and he goes out to the truck and passes out. And then the bass player, Donnie, he comes up to me and goes, "Man, Sean's passed out in the back of the truck." He goes, "Remember how we spooked this all the way here, and he was just like wouldn't stop yelling and being obnoxious and stuff?" So he goes, "Let's go mess with him." So we went to the back of the truck and, you know, opened up the tailgate, started shaking it, yelling, 12-pack, 12-pack. Of course, he wasn't very happy about that.
In one of my many quests to belong during my teenage years, I became attracted to a punk movement called Straight Edge. What I thought made sense about this strain of supposedly nonconformist culture was that its adherents abstained from alcohol and drugs and claimed to be celibate. Considering all the overdoses and free-flowing exchanges of venereal diseases that were going on at the time, this lifestyle made total sense to me, especially if it could be done outside of the context of what I thought was the fascism of religion. Well, for me, that phase only ended up lasting about 15 minutes. when I found that to belong to that group, one had to submit to another kind of fascism, or groupthink, rather. Knowing Mr. Tidball to be a pretty clean-living guy, I asked if the straight edgers were a factor during his punk career.
I was straight edge before I knew what straight edge was. Mm-hmm. I mean, so when I got into punk rock, I found there was a straight edge movement. To me, it was like, well, cool. There's, you know, I mean, to me, it was just, you know, cool that there were so many different, once again, the whole reason I got into it, so many different aspects there, you know, you didn't have to be one thing. You could be a lot of different things. But you're right. I mean, you know, I mean, I never really fit in with the straight edge movement, even when I was completely, you know, not drinking or anything. Because
I mean,
just,
I mean, for people listening, you know, well, I remember, I mean, you didn't drink, you didn't smoke, you didn't even have sex.
Yeah.
I mean,
the sex thing was...
I wonder how long that was going to last.
Yeah, well, the thing about the sex thing is, I don't know if I knew any straight-edge person that really went completely without sex, you know? Right. It was, you know, I think that all came from that... I think that line was just from that Minor Threat song, you know, where he said, I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't... I mean, maybe I'm wrong, I don't know that much about Ian McKay, but I think, I mean, I know now I think he's married, but... I would hope he's having sex if he's married. But I think even at the time, I mean, surely, you know, maybe not. I mean, he may have been completely celibate, but if so, I think he was the only one. And I think a lot of people heard that and, you know, just and assumed that meant, you know, I'm supposed to be completely celibate all the time. I've heard, you know, and this is secondhand. I didn't read an interview with Ian McKay myself that said this, but my understanding is what he meant by that was basically, you don't go out and have a lot of one-night stands, you know, because you're trying, you know, you want to have some level of morality and you know, be respectful. And I have talked to people that saw Minor Threat when they played in Nashville. And in fact, a friend of mine, I think he saw him and he said that, you know, what, you know, Ian's big thing. I mean, in addition to being just kind of, like you say, very, what was the word you used? Fascistic almost? You know?
Fascist.
Yeah, yeah. Of his own.
Or authoritarian, maybe.
Authoritarian, yeah. Like after Minor Threat played, like some of the guys of the band like had this woman's bra or something and said like, oh, we trade her a t-shirt for a bra and all. And he got mad and said, go take that back to her, give it back to her and apologize because that's disrespectful. So it was, you know, kind of like this real, you know, ultra
conservative.
Almost, yeah,
I mean, yeah.
Ultra, I don't know, ultra conservative.
Or
ultra
Puritan.
PC.
Or
yeah,
ultra Puritan. Or PC, yeah, I guess, yeah.
Moving on, Mr. Tidball's next gig was as a member of the band Fun Girls from Mount Pilot.
Let's educate folks who, again, aren't from here, but also aren't from the South and don't realize who the Fun Girls from Mount Pilot are, the originals.
Okay.
So.
Well, the original Fun Girls from Mount Pilot were not a band. They were characters from the Andy Griffith Show.
Yes.
And,
Hello, doll.
That's right. Daphne and... Skippy and Daphne, yeah. Hi, doll, yeah.
Bernie.
Hello, doll.
Hi, Bernie.
I think I mentioned our bass player was in this, you know, joint from right next to Pain, put this band together. He put Fun Girls from Mount Pilot together, and he moved over to guitar, and he started writing songs, and his... learning songs from Rednecks and Pain, his first few songs sounded like Rednecks and Pain, really fast with slow moshy parts. In the meantime, I went off to grad school in Auburn, and I'd been exposed to more different types of underground music that I hadn't heard before. A lot of, you know, garage music, surf music, rockabilly, you know, underground, even more different kinds of indie rock and stuff. And then, you know, was discovering, and it's a terrible word to say now, but pop punk, you know, it's now you say pop punk, people think Blink 182 and Sum 41 and these other even worse bands. But at the time, it was kind of a, you know, Screeching Weasel, Mr. T experience. Bands were more influenced by the Descendants and the Buzzcocks, the kind of the first wave of that before Green Day exploded.
Right.
But I mean, at the time, it was really cool. It still had a lot of edge to it. It still sounded punk, even though it had melody to it, which I'm a sucker for melody anyway. Right. When he was writing, after his like second or third song, went from da 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 da, I really got sick of the slow down parts. There's real slow in the middle parts, and I said, I started saying, can you do something different there? Can we maybe do something more mid-paced or whatever? And it became more of a real collaborative effort. Like in Rednecks and Pain, mostly our guitar player wrote a song, and that's what we did. You know, we all just played our parts to his song. You know, when Donnie started bringing songs to the table, you know, I started feeling more comfortable making more musical suggestions. Even though I can't play anything, saying, can you do a part maybe like this, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, Troy joined him, got really good at bass, and he learned to play really well. He started writing stuff, and and it opened, and he started putting his two cents in and contributing, and even our drummer, you know, and Brandon explained the drummer just put a beat to things. So he started coming up with ideas. So it became more of a collaborative thing where we all were really pitching in ideas. Maybe she just thinks I'm in the way, but she won't give me the time of day. Maybe it's just something that's been letting her drum break at my head. Well, it's too music all night, she can swear. Touch the scarf right now, I don't care if you do. I love you, puts me out, give her a show. Girlfriend hates me and I think you ought to know.
At that time, what were some of the bands that you played with?
Teen Idols were the, you know, to me, the other, you know, the big other big Nashville band that, and they were kind of opposite. We're in like Fun Girl, and with in Nashville and Huntsville, you know, like that realm, Fun Girls from Mount Pilot kind of ruled, and Teen Idols were kind of secondary. But Teen Idols were definitely the much bigger band nationally and internationally. Even they toured around, they played all across the U.S. They got a lot of notoriety. They got, you know, record. They put CDs out on Fat Records. They play with a lot of big bands, and just, you know, it's kind of that Nashville curse. It still happens today. You'll have a band, you know, Nashville has like one or two local bands that they really love and ignores everyone else. But these other bands, they'll go out and, you know, they'll become huge in other places. And the same with bands coming to town, you know. Unless it's like a band as big as the White Stripes or something, you bring a band that's somewhat well known in the independent music scene to Nashville, they have their worst crowds of their whole tour. Huh. And but yet they can play, you know, every other place in the U.S. and have an amazing turnout.
Having lived here a long time, I feel like there's just too many musicians here. Like nobody's impressed.
Yeah,
you can't throw a rock about hitting a musician. I've tried.
I think that's part of it.
And,
the Fun Girls were known for their outrageous stage shows. For an example,
I think the funniest thing we ever did live was our bass player. He always seemed like he came up with the best costume ideas, and he would just, and so one show he decided he was going to dress like a pregnant woman, and so in fall fitting that theme, I decided to dress like a nurse. And not only did he dress like a pregnant woman, we decided he was going to deliver. He was going to deliver the baby on stage.
Oh my goodness!
So, and of course, people didn't know it. We didn't clue them in that we were going to do. We just, you know, they'd see, you know, he came out as a pregnant woman. It's like, okay, you know, Troyette is likely to give birth any minute now. So, you know, we're going to go through the show as much as we can. And, you know, I was dressed like a nurse, and I'm prepared to assist with the delivery when necessary. And about halfway through the show, he started doing his fake deep breathing and all. And he had a water balloon. And so he punched it out, so his frog broke and, you know, dripped on it and spilled on the stage. And so then he laid down the stage and, you know, had, of course, a big dress on. And until, you know, I put on rubber gloves and I went in there, and he had this bag, this like Ziploc freezer bag. And it was full of like spaghetti and, you know, you know, fake blood and everything, and just, you know, I was pulling out all this crap, you know, and I mean, I think I'm even pulling some like rags and stuff that wasn't supposed to be there. And it was just nasty. And then I pulled out this, you know, baby doll covered in all this crap.
Wow, that's a lot of thought, man.
Oh yeah, we when we came up with ideas, we put a lot into it. So.
You know, life has its ups and downs, and the trick is, I think, to sometimes exploit the downs. If life gives you crap, make fertilizer. The Fun Girls did just that with a disappointing incident that Tidball next explains.
We had a show booked in Johnson City, Tennessee, or Bristol, Wyoming. They're basically the same place. So, you know, we drove to this place, you know, and that's a pretty good drive from Nashville. We get to the place we're supposed to play. It was a record store, and it was closed. You know, no one called to tell us, you know, that the show was canceled or anything.
And it was like closed down.
Yeah, temporarily shut down due to codes or something like that. So we took our Sharpies and wrote on the walls of the building, like, thanks a lot for calling us, you know, assholes and stuff like that. So, like, the Monday, we get back, and Donnie, he was always booking our shows, but he this is back before cell phones and all that. Always call and check his answer machine from the road. And, you know, of course, like I say, no messages, you know, and no hang-ups or anything, because he had caller ID. But on Monday, he had a message after this had happened, after we'd left all our messages there. And it was a very angry answer machine message from the owner of the building, you know,
smart-ass assholes. You little pseudo-punts that think you know every f***ing thing. Well, you don't know, pal. You're a little two-faced. You're friendly to my face when you want me to push your little records. And then you go and do this stupid f***ing. Well, pal, we're going to hunt your damn ass down. You better start getting you some leg braces because you're going to end up hobbling around here like Bobby Steele is, you little assholes.
So we took the answer machine message, and we had a song. We had a song we'd been playing forever, but we hadn't recorded yet about wrestling, called "Monkey Flips," and about getting in the ring and fighting and all that. And so when we recorded it, we took the message from the answer machine and put that as before the song on the record.
Did he ever hear it? Do you think?
I think we sent him a copy. I don't know.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know. He did.
It's great.
I know that the records we left with him to sell, he, that's another thing we did too. He sent back one of the records and he had like scratched it up and written on it, you know, like on Fun Girls from Out Pilot. He wrote over the word Fun Girls with faggots.
Wow.
and it was like, and he goes, and it's something like, you ain't getting your money for the records you left with me, and all that. Just a real redneck guy. Aww. So we put pictures of that in the next record.
That's right, yeah. That gives you the street credit.
Yeah, right? Exactly, yeah.
She was a girl from Birmingham. She just had an abortion. She was a case of insanity. Her name was Polly. She lived a tree. She was another...
We played a show in Huntsville once, and... you know, because I always say, Troy had come up with like the best costume ideas, and for this show he was the Smurfette, and he actually colored himself completely blue for it.
I think
it.
I've seen the picture for that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's on one of our records actually. And I can't remember what my costume was, but something I wore had required cleanup for me too. Either I had face paint on, or I colored my hair, or something, because for whatever reason we played it like it was like after hours. We played inside a shopping mall, and I don't understand why we couldn't clean up there at the restrooms there after the show. Maybe they were closed.
But the show was in the shopping mall?
Yeah, it was like after hours. It was like in the middle of the mall. In
really?
Huntsville. Yeah, it was the weirdest thing. Yeah. Like almost like Tiffany or something.
Yeah, I was going to say. That's
but yeah, I mean, it was after hours. I mean, apparently, so it wasn't like you had mall traffic coming through there. We stopped at a Waffle House on the way back. And so Troy and I were in the Waffle House.
Still with your face paint.
Yeah, well, he's covered completely head to toe blue. You know, I don't know if I had face paint or hair color or what, but I remember we were both in there cleaning up. But I remember him, he was like taking paper towels and scrubbing this blue stuff off him. And I was over at the sink, I don't know, I forget if I was washing my face or, you know, cleaning my hair or what. And this dude walked in, I mean, just big, tough looking, you know, black dude, you know, looked like he, you know, could play, you know, play football or something. He just walks in there, looking around, looking at, you know, while we're seeing the blue guy clean himself, and me, whatever, I can't remember what I was, but he doesn't even go to the restroom. He goes to the paper towel rack, like, flicks it twice, rips off a paper towel, and just takes a paper towel and goes, I'm going to get the f***ing one out of here. And just walked out.
You know, stuff just seems to happen to Charles and his friends when he goes to eating establishments.
Me and some of the guys I was trying to do a band with, they were still in high school. I was in college. We went over to my house to try to work up some songs. So afterwards, it was pretty late. We were heading back. We were taking them back to Nashville. And we stopped at Crystal to eat. And these, like I say, this is in the 80s before, you know, nowadays people can color their hair and color their nails or whatever, and no one says anything about it. Back then, you looked even a little bit weird. It was, you could kind of fight in certain communities. And, you know, I guess I looked weird enough for the time with, my fright wig of blonde hair or whatever. But these guys were like mohawks, spiked up, and, you know, heavy eyeliner and colored nails and things like that. And the other guy with us, he wasn't playing music with me. He's just a friend of mine. Big, huge, tall hippie guy. I mean, like 6'3", 200 something pounds. And so we're eating, and these guys come into this restaurant, Crystal, and stereotypical, jock redneck types, whatever. You know, one of them's even got a shirt unbuttoned down to his navel and all, and he's got their big haired girlfriends with him and all. And they sit down, and I think they'd obviously been drinking, and they started making smart-ass comments to us and all, and always open my mouth in the wrong times. And so I finally said something, and when the guy said something like, hey, you know, hey, real men don't paint their nails. And I said, yeah, real men don't wear checkered shirts unbuttoned to their navel either. And this dude got freaking, he was just like waiting for something to set him off, I guess, because I guess he wanted to fight. And I guess that was it, because he jumped up and just, he got just furiously mad. He just ran over to the table and goes, it's not checkered, it's plaid. And he like, you know, got down in my face at the table and I can't remember if he grabbed me or what, but I remember I grabbed the napkin holder off the table. And he was like, you gonna hit me with that? And I said, if you hit me, I will. And so he does this little, like, kind of light love tap tag on my shoulder with his open hand or something. You know, which was really nothing that should have, you know, prompted a reaction. But it was like almost like out of pride because I had said that and because he, you know, made contact. I took the napkin holder and I swung for him. And he stood up when I swung for him, so I didn't get his face. I hit his chest. And the nap was just poof. It was just like this big explosion of happenings everywhere. And it was like we were just like looking at each other. I guess we were just like startled that anything had happened at all. And he goes, that didn't hurt. And then we just like, and then it was like immediately grappling. Me and him were like, you know, freaking having a wrestling match or whatever on the ground. And apparently his other friend jumps up to join in. So my big hippie friend, he grabs the one guy off of me. And he pulls him back, and yeah, I've still got my hands locked around his throat like a freaking death grip, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna freaking, you know, choke the guy, because I get a pretty hot temper anyway, and I'm fuming at this point. So he pulls him away from him while, you know, I got my hand on his throat, and his other friend, you know, comes to take a swing at my hippie friend. Mm-hmm. My hippie friend keeps saying every time we talk about this, it's like, if I had just waited 2 seconds before I pulled the guy around, he would have hit his own friend. If I had just waited. And so the crystal people working there are like freaking out and all. They're like, the police have been called. You know, y'all better break this up and all that. And I was like, going, I don't care. Bring them on. You know, so these guys, they go out to their car. And one of the guy's girlfriends goes, that's okay. Everybody knows faggots can't fight anyway. And I'm going out there yelling, saying, why don't you come see how I fight? You know, so after all this is over, I'm like going, I'm looking at the two guys that they were the main targets of the instigation. Right. Yeah, the mean-looking punk guys, and going, why didn't y'all do anything? And they go, because we're pacifists.
All right. Who out there likes a beat-up guy smaller than them? All right, meet me after the show.
Tidball's next phase in life, a wrestling manager named Cat Taylor.
For the folks that aren't familiar with the sophisticated world of wrestling, the manager is the character, too, and yes. He often will get into a scruff.
The manager's the guy on the outside of the ring that comes in with the big wrestlers and introduces them and says, you know, usually they're the mouthpiece for them. Back in the old days, there aren't as many managers now. Now, pretty much, wrestlers have to be able to do their own talking, but back in the days, when I started liking it.
Yeah, it's just trash talking, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of trash talking, and it's what we call generating heat. I mean, you know, a big guy, if he's a good wrestler or whatever, you know, he might not get the right kind of heat because he's tough. But, you know, you got this little weasley guy outside the ring, and people want to see him get his ass kicked, and no one can because he's not in the ring.
Right. If you don't mind, give us an example of Cat Taylor. Like, what would he say if I was the wrestler? Or let's say this lamp here is the wrestler, and I'm the guy who's going to wrestle the lamp. So what are you going to tell me about this lamp?
Oh, yes. Well, you got me on the spot here because I haven't got to know this lamp very well. But I would probably say something. It would probably be something like Spun Counter Guy, you do not know what you're getting yourself into. Have you seen this lamp? This is the brightest, most awesome lamp that you will ever face in the ring. You step foot in that ring, and he's going to smash you into little pieces. And I'm going to come in and laugh in your face, and you're just a stepping stone on the way to the Electric Light World Championship. If you're smart, you would walk out right now and go see all your little hillbilly friends sitting out there in the audience, these inbred, redneck, genetic throwbacks, and let us take this victory and not even have to break a sweat. But by changing into our freaking ring gear. This is ridiculous. What the heck do you think you're doing? You are lower class, underclass, no class compared to the amazing lamp. Something like that.
That's great. Wow. And that would make the crowd mad because you just call them a bunch of inbreds.
Well, yeah, that's a cheap heat when you go after the crowd.
Do you ever feel like you went too far and like you had some people waiting up for you in the parking lot afterwards?
There was a time, and whether I was right or whether I was wrong, I'm still not sure. You know, it depends who you talk to about. I thought the guy was serious. They said that he was just, you know, what we call smart marks. One knows what's going on. He was trying to play up. But when you're in the audience, you're never supposed to cross the line and touch the wrestlers or get past the crowd and around the ring. Well, in Petersburg, there was a guy that several times had, you know, doing things, like coming out of the crowd, you know, getting by the ring, you know.
He's just a...
Just a fan, yeah.
Okay.
And I was starting to get concerned. I think this guy's really, you know, serious here, you know. There's a certain line, and the security's not stopping him. The security was weak. Yeah, he was, you know, doing his thing, and I was, of course, you know, responding. And he said something like, "I got something for you out in the car," and he went out, and he left the building. I was like, "Oh crap!" It's, you know, so I started. I got concerned if I started carrying mace around with me. You know, I was like, I think this guy's really losing it. So there was one match we did, and we had cheated and won or something, and we were leaving, and he kept coming out of the crowd and trying to get at me or whatever. And it was, we were walking through at the steps. He was like, he had broke through the crowd and rushed me. You know. So I pulled out the mace and I zapped him in the face with it.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he went freaking down. And then I was so mad. I was like, yelling. I'm saying.
And the whole crowd saw this?
Yeah, they were very mad. And the promoters were mad at me, saying, "Why the hell did you do that for? You know, we could get sued and all that." It's like, dude's coming for me. And, you know, your security's doing this. They were holding him back. It's like, I didn't see him holding him back. It looked to me like he broke free of him. And, you know, he's bigger than me. And they're like,
did anything ever come of it? Was that the end of it? Or?
Well, they banned me from working in Petersburg for a few weeks, but they did allow me to come back, and they said, "Promise not to bring your mace with you."
And, did that guy show up to your next show?
He did show up, but he toned down after that. Okay. They said that they talked to him, and they said, like, "Oh, he just don't know. He we're probably going to be training him and all that."
Really?
And I was like, "Oh, really?"
He's auditioning, huh?
Yeah, remember that after the mace incident, he did wait for me outside, and I tried to. And actually tried to leave through the window, and he saw me coming, so I couldn't do that. I had to get security to.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's hard to lose a number like that. You don't think of them all at once, but when you see a figure like that, it makes you wonder and thank God we all have sold that many.
About 15 years ago, I was planning on having some friends and coworkers over to my apartment to play cards and whatnot. And one friend said that she couldn't find a babysitter for her daughters. My reply was, "Ah, heck, they can come too." She thought they might get bored, but I assured her there would be some entertainment for them too. So I asked Mr. Tidball if Photon, the masked, mute Japanese wrestler, could make an appearance at my party. Sure enough, he did, and the kids loved him, subjecting him to kidney crush jabs and powder puff death grips. Charles explained Photon's origins.
It originally started kind of just like a little side project I wanted to do. It was, like I say, I'd gotten in shape. I was getting kind of tired of managing, and I was getting tired of seeing people that hadn't been trained, you know, wrestling, that didn't look like they were wrestlers. And, I didn't want to completely give up managing, so I wanted to create a character that was so that I could wrestle under. It was so different from Cat Taylor that, you know, no one would ever even know it was.
It wasn't the same person.
Right, yeah. And, you know, a lot of times you'll see people, they'll do things like they come in under a mask, and you're supposed to know it's them under the mask. And I stressed to everybody in there, the promoters, the bookers, the wrestlers, like, don't do anything that says this is Cat Taylor. This is not supposed to be the same character. I'm really supposed to be a whole different character. You know, it's not supposed to be a thing where the mask comes off and it's Cat Taylor. This is a Japanese guy. You know, he's, you know, full face mask, covers up every inch of my face, has even had fake hair in the back coming out. You know, and when I was a manager, I always wore suits and stuff, so you couldn't see that I got in shape. Everyone thought I was still a skinny little guy. And, you know, and I was trying to, you know, just wrestle in a style that didn't even, you know, kind of look Japanese even, which, you know, it may have been part of my downfall because I wasn't really trained how to do that. But
like somebody was in the crowd, was like, "Hey, that's not Japanese style."
They wouldn't know that. But, I mean, I would make mistakes. I try to do some things I wasn't really capable of doing. To me, mistakes aren't a big deal. Right. That's the thing is, you know, that's something I guess that comes from my punk rock upbringing. Is that, you know, one of the beautiful things about punk is, who cares if you mess up? It's not about perfection. Mm. It's about energy and desire. And that's the way I took wrestling. Well. Other wrestlers don't take it that way. You make a mistake in a ring, and it's like, you suck, you know. You, and it's like, well, at least I'm trying to do something different than you are. Right. I'm not just trying to do the same freaking headlock all the time, right. You know.
Now, Photon didn't talk.
No, he wouldn't. That's another thing, too. I didn't want to talk because, one, it would, you know, I was supposed to be Japanese, and two, you know, my voice would be recognized.
And your Japanese is not fluent, I assume?
Absolutely not. Plus, I still have an American Southern accent. Yeah. So, you know, and they would know that was Cat Taylor. So.
Konnichiwa, yeah. Y'all. I remember there was a bit of a controversy where people were starting to whisper that Cat Taylor and Photon were the same person.
Yeah, that's the, well, like I say, part of the whole problem with the thing in wrestling that I was getting sick of with people not being trained is they also, there's certain etiquette and ethics, you know, that you're supposed to have when you're doing this. And we call it stooging things off, you know. I mean, while that, granted, everyone knows that it's a show and that you're not, you know, really.
It's not real?
Yeah, exactly.
What?
Yeah, exactly, you know. And there were too many people that, you know.
Ran their mouth.
Yeah, and it was, so it kind of killed it, and, you know, I quit doing it. But
I thought you had a moment where Cat Taylor and Photon appeared to the same.
We tried that, yeah. It's almost more complicated to explain than, okay. You know. I mean, I can
It didn't
try.
Work?
Yeah, it's maybe. I think it created enough confusion mm-hmm. that people didn't really know, mm-hmm. you know, who Photon was when he was, but I think they still thought at least sometimes it had been Cat Taylor.
I see.
I had another guy wrestling the mask, and Cat came out there.
Sure.
I claimed it was like, it's my mask and I'm Photon, and I was having like the announcer say, no, you're not, you're a freaking manager at all. So I was trying to like do reverse psychology.
Yeah, wow.
It's like, you know, if a bad guy says he's not then, mm-hmm. you know. And I was making it like completely, trying to make it as obvious that I wasn't, like doing silly things like putting the mask on wrong and, you know, and stuff like that, you know. You know, and then I even had another guy come out, like after I took the mask and said it was me and wearing my suit, mm-hmm. I even had like a guy come out to ring wearing the Cat Taylor suit and the Photon mask, wow. And I was backstage on the microphone doing the voice, like to make them think that was Cat. So when I came out as Photon in a different mask and beat up, took my mask back and covered, you know, even his head was covered, they'd think that Photon got his real
mask. Dang, yeah, that's complicated.
It is, and you know, like I say, I think it just confused people more than anything.
Quick, what was Photon's greatest moment?
That's a good question. Well, to me, I always felt like it was, well, the first title belt I ever won was as Photon. It was in Petersburg.
Now, how does the awards work? I mean, obviously, you know, if something's scripted like it is, mm-hmm. how do you win awards? I mean, how does that work?
It's up to whoever's booking the show, who they decide they want to make a champion at the time and why. Like at that particular moment, There's usually more than one championship belt. There's the main heavyweight championship belt, and then there's like a tag team champion. Sometimes you'll have like a secondary champion. Like in this case, it was a light heavyweight champion, I don't know why they chose me to do it, but there was the guy who was a light heavyweight champion at the time. He was a really good wrestler, and you know, they were kind of wanting to elevate him to the top level to get to the, you know, to be their main champion. So they had to get that belt off him first. He had to lose light heavyweight belt to somebody. And for some reason, they decided to have me be the one to take it from him. Why, I don't really know.
You get to take the belt home? Or?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I own it now. It ended up being sold to somebody who owed me money, and he gave me the belt.
Wow.
Though these days, Tip Ball spends a lot of his spare time writing articles on comic books for BleedingCool.com and funny fish sandwich reviews for TheBrefisticate.com, he still can't seem to shake his punk rock wrestling call. Thus, his next project.
Me and several of the people from the band, the Exotic Ones, we're working on combining my love of wrestling with my love of punk rock and putting together a wrestling themed group called. Right now, we're probably going to call it the Memphis Jabronis.
So. Okay. So all the lyrics are going to be about wrestling?
Yeah, we mainly talked about just covering like songs that wrestlers, you know, that wrestlers sang and use, which is gonna be awful.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are also some punk rock songs about wrestling already existing, and then I've actually started writing, you know, even though I wasn't originally intended to be anything but covers, I've actually started getting ideas for original wrestling songs. I've got like sets of like four or five lyrics at home, so if we move to that, but you know, getting a little ahead of things, you know.
Yeah.
In the Corner, Back by the Woodpile podcast is produced by A Closet, A Pocket, and A Suitcase. You can email us at spuncounterguy@hotmail.com. And a special thanks to TheBrofisticate.com.